From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the May 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, The Bismarck. This is another story about the triumphs and agonies of the Bletchley Park Codebreakers. It happened here, although in this case it didn't exactly. All will become clear when we delve into the tale of how the iconic German battleship was located and sunk by the Royal Navy, with a bit of help from Bletchley Park. It's a great example of the importance of some of the lesser known techniques, including direction finding and traffic analysis. Also coming up, a special Bletchley Park beer is being launched at the Father's Day barbecue next month, and there's news about the 1940s boutique too. Before all that though, Dermot Turing opened up his family archive to give a rare insight into the man who's become a figurehead for the breathtaking achievements of the Bletchley Park Codebreakers, his uncle, Alan Turing. Alan died before Dermot was born, but his legend looms large in the family, and now Dermot has written a book debunking some of the myths that have grown up about this intriguing man and giving a unique family perspective on his remarkable work and the tragic end to his life. Dermot gave a talk at Bletchley Park, sharing some of what's in his book, Prof. Alan Turing Decoded.
Thank you. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you for the welcome. Welcome to Bletchley Park. What I'm going to focus on is Alan Turing's World War II experience, some of which wasn't actually at Bletchley Park, so that will be of some interest. After leaving Sherborne, Alan went to King's College, Cambridge, and the maths course at Cambridge was a sort of slightly curious creature, and they had essentially a postgraduate year for very bright kids. They could sort of basically stay on and do an extra year after the other students had graduated, and this was clearly, it was sort of a staging post for sort of taking an academic career. Kind of these days, they probably call it a master's degree, but you sort of didn't get anything for it other than sort of a pat on the back, really. But Alan took this course, and his professor on one of the fundamental programs that they were teaching, which was about the rules underpinning the rules that underpin mathematics. Sounds a bit strange. It's very, very abstract, but we all know that arithmetic follows particular rules. And then there's a question, well, are there rules about how you construct those rule books? And so this is the topic that was being lectured on. The question in particular that Newman, the professor, was focused on was this thing called the Entscheidungs problem, the decidability problem. The question whether the rules about rules said that there was invariably some kind of process that you could apply ahead of time to know whether any given proposition was provable or not. And so what Newman described this as is there a mechanical process? Is there a machine that could actually say ahead of time whether any particular proposition was provable or not? Could you just shove the proposition into the machine and see if it says, yep, that one's provable, no, that one isn't? Is it possible? And this is very interesting because his idea of a machine set Alan Turing thinking. And this had been like one of these unsolved problems in higher mathematics, probably the very rarefied mathematics, but been sitting around for 25 years and nobody'd actually been able to prove one way or other whether there was a solution to this decidability problem. And Alan Turing wrote this paper in 1936 called On Computable Numbers with an Application to the Entscheidungs Problem, and he described in this a machine that could actually do this job that Newman had described. But he proved that actually that machine was impossible to build, which meant that he'd solved the Entscheidungs problem, and therefore this is his most famous paper that he ever wrote in the whole of his life, which he wrote at the age of 23 and a half. But the point for the rest of us is that this paper set out essentially a blueprint for a programmable computing machine where you could actually feed in a different program and then the machine would carry out a different job. And this was something that nobody had ever conceived of before 1936. And so this was a complete radical breakthrough. Nobody could actually build one of these things, but the idea that you could reprogram a machine and then it would do a different task was just an amazing idea. And so, of course, that's the blueprint for the modern computer. Now, this kind of way of thinking typifies a lot of sort of Alan Turing's approach to life, because he's quite hands-on, he's quite practical. Please don't let him near your kitchen because he would make a complete disaster, you know, and the descriptions of what happens when he was let loose with a soldering iron don't bear thinking about. But he wanted to be hands-on, he wanted to do it himself, he wanted to think in sort of practical terms, he wanted to build real physical objects that would do things. He wasn't that rarefied as a mathematician. He wanted to actually get dirty with the machines. So that's very interesting, this whole idea that he wasn't just going to sit there and do equations on squared paper. He was actually wanting to get involved in the machinery. That's very unusual for mathematicians, particularly of that vintage. We get back to Cambridge. So Frank Adcock is a Room 40 veteran, okay? And he, like several other Room 40 veterans, is a fellow of King's College, Cambridge. After World War I, he retires from code breaking, but he remains on essentially the Room 40 reserve list. And his job, when it comes to 1937, and war with Germany is looking increasingly likely, by 1938, he has been basically officially hired by Room 40, or the Government Code and Cipher School, as it now is, to go around and scout for talent for Bletchley Park. And where better to look than amongst the eccentric people on high table in your college? And that had people like Dilly Knox, who's one of Bletchley Park's most famous codebreakers and also a Room 40 veteran, and it had Alan Turing. And Alan Turing's got just those skills they're looking for. Yes, he's crap at ancient Greek, but you don't need ancient Greek anymore to be a cryptographer. What you have got to cope with is the idea that codes and ciphers have become mechanized. You need people who have got mathematical skills and understand about machinery in order to be able to crack those kinds of things. So we're looking for a different class of codebreaker. And so that's why Alan got basically recruited by Adcock in probably September 38. It's the timing's not absolutely clear, but certainly by January 1939, he'd been sent off to do some cryptology courses in London run by the GCNCS, and he'd been introduced to the Enigma machine, and he was having various conversations with Dilly Knox about how you actually crack these things. So that was all happening well before war broke out. He was working on the Enigma in his rooms at King's College, Cambridge. The problem is not getting your hands on an Enigma machine. The problem with the Enigma machine is it can be set up every day in billions of different ways. So the question is not having the machine, it's knowing how it was set up every day, and that changes every day. So the problem for the codebreakers is not having access to an Enigma machine, it's having access to the tables that were being distributed around the German armed forces, telling their cipher clerks how to set the machine up every day. We didn't have those. We captured some on battlefields after, you know, a few years of the war, but that's not going to really keep you up to date. They needed to have some means of actually cracking the key, the daily settings. And that's where Alan Turing comes in, because he invented the bomb. And the purpose of this was actually to eliminate billions of the impossible settings based on what's essentially a crib. So the Germans would send out stereotyped messages like, okay, can you imagine this? They actually sent out the weather forecast. Okay, I can understand why they were broadcasting the weather, but they decided that the weather forecast was a secret, and so they enciphered it on the Enigma machine, and they used the helpful word weather forecast in German. That's very helpful, because if you know every single message coming from that particular ship stationed out in the North Atlantic is going to begin with weather forecast, you actually know what the plain text is and you know what the enciphered text is. That gives you a way of actually eliminating some of the impossible settings for the day. And so the bomb is designed to help you eliminate billions of the impossible settings. Alan Turing's modelled in work particularly well. Gordon Welshman, who is another one of the brilliant cryptographers here at Bletchley Park, put a very clever addition onto it called the diagonal board. That made it actually work to the point where this could become a performing machine and actually find the settings and keep the Allied forces on top of the code breaking on a daily basis. One of the most interesting things is that there are documents in the archives here at Bletchley Park which are blueprints. They're engineering drawings prepared for the British Tabulating Machine Company, which is actually making these machines. And they date from the 1st of September 1939. Okay, when did the war break out? So all that work that had been being done at King's College, Cambridge, before the war, was already manifesting itself by as early as September 1939 as a plan for a machine to find the settings on the Enigma machine. So essentially, the British Tabulating Machine Company was preparing its prototype by Christmas 1939. The prototype was delivered in the spring of 1940. Didn't work particularly well, as I've explained. But it meant that with Welshman's modification, they were actually having a working bomb here in time for the Battle of Britain, which is when it began to matter for the Brits. They were one step ahead of the game, and I think that's just remarkable. Okay, so if actually he'd really basically done the design work by autumn 1939, can't pinpoint a particular date, but, you know, round about then, what on earth did he spend the whole of the rest of the war doing? You know, if this was his major achievement, was to design that thing. Well, first of all, this is very interesting, this thing. This is a piece of paper. And it was found stuffed in Hut 6 when Hut 6 was being restored so that visitors can actually go into it. And, I mean, can you imagine how miserable it was here during the war when these rooms were boiling in the summer, but more importantly, freezing in the very, very cold winters they had during World War II. I think 1939 to 40 was probably one of the coldest winters on record. You've probably seen the pictures of people skating on the lake and so forth. So they were taking pieces of paper like this and they stuffed them in the cracks to keep the drafts out. We are delighted that they did that, because there's two pieces of paper like this, which you can see in Hut 12. Okay, so you can go and see an exhibition about the sort of what we found out during the restoration work, which is quite interesting. You'll see these two pieces of paper there. These are Banbury sheets. This is about naval Enigma. And the problem with naval Enigma was that the German Navy was much more well-organized about how it set about sending the messages, describing to the recipient how their Enigma machines had been set up for the day. They had a different process in the Navy from the Army and the German Air Force. And what the Banbury sheets were trying to do was to help the codebreakers identify, or at least eliminate, unlikely possibilities for which rotors were being used, and in particular which one was the fast rotor on the German Navy Enigma. So you've got the whole alphabet running down in vertical columns, and they've punched out the message, and they're running these punched sheets against each other to eliminate unlikely rotor combinations. That technique, the Banbury sheets technique, Banburismus they called it, they like to call their code-breaking techniques the way that German mathematicians would call mathematical techniques. So they all ended in ismus. So there's Turing-ismus was another thing that came up later on. And this was Banburismus. So they used these sheets that were made in, printed in Banbury and then punched here. And so it was problems like this that kept him occupied for maybe the first couple of years of the war. Then his career changes in about 1942. And so I think it is probably fair to say, well, hang on, if he'd solved the Enigma problems by so early in the war, what did he spend the rest of the war doing? I think by 1942, his role as a code breaker was probably towards its end, actually. And they sent him off to America. And there were various reasons for sending him off to America, but the first one was to check out the integrity of a new teleprinter cipher machine that had been invented by what was essentially Allied intelligence. It was the Canadians working together with the Brits in New York. But they'd come up with this thing called the ROCX, which was this teleprinter encryption device. And so Alan was basically being sent out to check out whether it was secure or not. The reason it was called the ROCX if you've been to Radio City in Manhattan in New York, you know the Rockettes, the famous dancers that they had. Apparently the dancers were going to sunbathe on the top of the Radio City building, which is right next to where the British Intelligence building was. So you could look out the window at these dancers sunbathing. So Alan Turing, being sexually inclined the way that he was, wasn't particularly going to be interested in the Rockettes, was he? But he spent his time on the machine, but the machine got itself named after the dancers anyway. So that was task number one. Task number two, while he was there, was to check out a four-rotor bomb. And this is because the German Navy had by this stage introduced a four-rotor Enigma machine for their U-boats. And they needed a special kind of bomb, essentially, for tackling this. If you ran the three-rotor bomb with an extra rotor on it, it would take 26 times as long to finish its run. Just using that sort of electromechanical technology that you see down in Block B, it just wasn't going to work. They needed something that was much faster and sexier, and so they used this thing, which has got a whole load of complicated electronics in it. This is a real state-of-the-art modern 1942 machine, which is, you know, I mean, you can tell from its appearance, it's obviously going to behave in a completely different way. So he went to go and help Joe Desch, who was the American engineer based in Dayton, Ohio, who was actually building this thing, to help him with his design and the various plans for that. Okay, but actually the real reason he was there is not to do these things at all. He was trying to get into Bell Labs, which was essentially the US equivalent of the post office engineering research establishment that was actually very closely connected with Bletchley Park's technical developments. Bell Labs was doing the same job for the US forces that the post office was doing here, and it was building a machine. And they were building a speech encipherment machine there. And Alan Turing's real brief from the UK government was, yes, by all means, sort of, you know, check out the ROCX and sort of see if you can help Joe Desch. But actually, what we want you to do is to check out the speech encipherment machine and tell us whether that is secure. Because they knew that Churchill's conversations over the radio telephone with President Roosevelt had been being listened into by the Germans, and the encryption level on it was so rubbish that the Germans could understand every word. There was just this little problem, and you won't be able to read the words on that slide for you, so I'll pick it off here. But this memo is dated 2nd of December 1942. Says, "This is not a big question, but I have to write to you about it because I'm told that people concerned are acting on your direct order." And this is going to General George C. Marshall in the US, and it's going from General Dill, who, after he'd sort of been kicked sideways out of being Churchill's chief of the Imperial General Staff, had been sent over to Washington to be the sort of chief liaison for UK forces in the US. So, okay, so this is Dill writing to Marshall. "A certain Dr. A.M. Turing, who is our leading authority on scrambling devices, has come over from England in the belief that he would be allowed to visit the Bell Laboratories for consultation on a highly secret telephone scrambling device which is being developed there. I understand that this construction of your scrambling device is well advanced, but it is considered too secret to allow Dr. Turing to look in on it." So Alan Turing had been kicking his heels for 3 months in the US, being denied access to this building to look at this speech encipherment device. And this very nearly blew up into a sort of like a diplomatic incident, but fortunately Dill and Marshall sort of calmed their junior officials down, and eventually Alan was allowed into this building to look at this thing. It was huge. It weighed, oh, I always get the numbers the wrong way around, it either weighed 40 tonnes and took up 50 racks of equipment, or it weighed 50 tonnes and took up 40 racks of equipment, but you get the general idea. It was kind of big, okay? And it was so big that when he had actually signed off and it said, yes, it's fine, they decided that they would bring one of these machines over to the UK so that Churchill could have his little chats with Roosevelt, this time securely. They couldn't find a building in Whitehall. It had to be on the ground floor because it was so big, didn't it? Because you couldn't put it upstairs. The floor would not cope. So they had to find a room on the ground floor. They couldn't find one in Whitehall that could actually accommodate this thing. So they ended up putting it in the basement of Selfridge's department store. But Alan Turing is scratching his head about this and he's thinking that this is ridiculous. You know, you don't need Selfridge's department store to do speech encipherment. So he comes back, and actually one of the projects that he worked on when he came back to the UK was to work on a speech encipherment machine that was about the size of an Enigma machine. In fact, the prototype of it, it's slightly larger than the briefcase, and it was called Delilah. And he got this sort of vision that actually you could then do speech encipherment for sort of like tank commanders talking to the tanks under their command, you know, instead of using just sort of plain language, which is obviously what normal communications are. Or you could have the same idea with a, you know, flight of military aircraft where they could actually talk to each other or to the ground without compromising operations. So, you know, the idea of a portable speech encipherment device was a very interesting one. They never developed it. They were too happy with this big thing they got in Selfridges. But where you sort of are getting to on this is that Alan Turing's role is very different from the one that he'd had right at the beginning of the war. He's not doing cryptography anymore. And if you just look at what Bletchley Park had turned into by March 1943 when he came back from the US, the size of the site here, you know, all those Victorian gardens had been ripped out, the maze had gone, you know, and all these hideous World War II era buildings. We don't pride them because of their architectural beauty. We think they're interesting because of what happened in them, but it's interesting. Okay, so, you know, it's basically turned into an industrial complex. It's become a factory. It's an industrial process, and it's not really the kind of place that needs the kind of Alan Turing sparks of genius kind of thing. So he actually worked up the road at Hanslope Park. Although he was kept on here at Bletchley in a sort of consulting role, in particular sort of keeping a finger in sort of various projects like the Colossus project. I mean, you know, again, one of the enduring Bletchley Park myths is that Alan Turing designed Colossus. No, he didn't. It was basically done by his old professor, Max Newman, ran the team that put the Colossus together and broke those Lorentz codes. But Alan Turing was involved in the teamwork around that. And again, another bunch of other sort of machinery-related projects that he was involved in. But he was actually up there at Hanslope Park working on things like his Delilah machine and continuing this role as the security guy, the security of communications person. So he's completely flipped around from being the person who's attacking German communications to vetting the security ally communications. So it's very interesting. And this sort of change of roles during World War II hasn't really been understood about him until very recently. It's always dreadful talking about the Alan Turing story because you sort of end up the end of his life with this sort of really downbeat note. So I try and liven it up a bit by giving you some tabloid headlines from the press at the time of his death, because some things haven't changed since 1954. I'll fish out some highlights for you. Okay, so they're very obsessed by the idea that Alan Turing was the mechanical brain expert. So we've got scientist robot brain man is found dead. Underneath the picture there, you can just about make out, it says Dr. Turing, he fed the brain. There's another one, another of these was apparatus in room. And you think, oh, yeah, that's... Brain expert took cyanide. There's a subtitle halfway through that article that says, did own cooking. I mean, really? Okay, that's probably the right note to end on.
On Sunday, the 19th of June, Bletchley Park is launching its very own beer, Station X, at a Father's Day barbecue. There'll be a swing band playing live, as well as freshly barbecued meat and vegetarian options, plus the chance to sample the new brew, created by Milton Keynes Brewery, Concrete Cow. Book now for the afternoon tea offer in the iconic Victorian mansion at Bletchley Park, available every weekend and throughout the school holidays. And at the next 1940s boutique on Saturday the 9th of July, pop-up vintage shop Clarabella's Closet will be back after a successful debut at the last boutique. Book now to spend the day learning to create an authentic vintage look with tricks of the trade from hair and makeup stylist Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo-Wop Doos. The Bismarck was a German battleship sunk by the Royal Navy, or sacrificed by the German Navy, depending which source you read, 75 years ago this month. Finding it in the Atlantic was no mean feat, but it was a hugely important task, both strategically and symbolically. Because if it had been able to complete the task it was built for, the results for Allied shipping would have been disastrous. Bletchley Park played its part in finding the Bismarck, even though it wasn't reading the relevant messages until several days after they'd been sent. I got to the bottom of this fascinating story with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
The Bismarck wasn't just another battleship, was it? It was quite a talisman, and it became something people were aware of and we were looking out for. Can you explain how we knew about it before it even existed?
Well, almost as soon as it was built, the Royal Navy became aware of it. The German Navy were building two battleships that were basically bigger than anybody else's battleships at the time, the Bismarck and the Tirpitz. And unlike the Royal Navy, as soon as they got a ship built, more or less, they got it into service as quickly as they could. The Germans were much more circumspect, so there was quite a long period when both ships were being fitted out and then being tested, and then the crews were being trained. And a lot of this happened in the Baltic and around North Germany. And all of that activity was followed both through signals intelligence and through photo reconnaissance. So they had airplanes going out and photographing the ships and the harbours.
It became something of a figurehead almost, something that would have been great for morale for us to defeat because operationally it was really important.
Yes, I mean, had Bismarck succeeded in getting out into the Atlantic and starting to attack convoys, it would have been absolutely disastrous because a ship of that size finding a convoy, the normal convoy escorts of destroyers or even cruisers would have stood no chance against it, and it would have been massively more dangerous than the U-boats that were operating out there at the time. So it was vital for the Royal Navy to stop it getting into open sea.
I guess things weren't going all that well for the Allies at that time anyway in the sea, were they?
Spring of 1941 is not a particularly good position for Britain. The risk of direct invasion has reduced after the Battle of Britain in late 1940, but the country is still essentially standing alone. The Americans aren't in the war yet. France has been defeated, so we're on our uppers at that point, so any good news would be very welcome.
Hamburg, den 14. Februar 1939. Heute beehrte unser geliebter Führer mit seiner Anwesenheit die Taufe des mächtigsten Schlachtschiffs, das die Welt jemals gesehen hat. 50.000 Tonnen groß, einen halben Meter des härtesten Panzerstahls rund um das Schiff und 8 Geschütze von 42 Zentimeter Kaliber machen dieses Schiff in eine unsinkbare Festung. Das Schlachtschiff Bismarck wurde seinen Elementen von der Enkelin des Eisernen Kanzlers übergeben. Dieser neue Beweis der deutschen Macht wird der Welt zeigen, dass die deutsche Flotte es mit jedem Feinde aufnehmen kann.
So the Bismarck did set sail, and obviously the Navy were very keen to stop it getting into its stride. What happens then?
The Royal Navy was very lucky in a number of ways because the Bismarck sailed from the Baltic and was spotted almost immediately by the Swedish Navy. And they were neutral during the Second World War, but they weren't particularly friendly to the Germans, and they were more friendly to the British. And we were fortunate that our naval attaché in Stockholm knew the right people in the Swedish Navy. The Swedes were very concerned that, because Norway was under German occupation at that point, that they might be next. So they were keeping a very close eye on what the Germans were up to. And so a message is sent via the attaché, naval attaché in Stockholm, to say that Bismarck has been sighted heading out through the Kattegat towards the North Sea. And of course, alarm bells go off at the Admiralty then that she's heading for sea and this could be a big danger. The Germans are also doing other things which give them away. And this is interesting about how intelligence works, that the Germans want to know where the Royal Navy is. So they increase air reconnaissance over Scapa Flow, which is the fleet's main base. And the Royal Navy, as soon as they see increased German air reconnaissance, they go, why are they doing that? They must be up to something. And so that, again, is a clue that they need to be more vigilant. So anyway, Bismarck sails, along with the cruiser Prince Eugen, stops various points on the Norwegian coast. And again, it's being shadowed by British aircraft, both Royal Navy and RAF aircraft, trying to spot it and trying to figure out what it's doing. And they manage to spot that it's not in one of the harbours that it had been in earlier. And thus it's at sea, and a number of Royal Navy ships in different parts of the North Sea and the North Atlantic are sort of mobilised, if you like, to try and intercept her. Because the real worry is that the choke point is between Scotland, Iceland and Greenland. There's two channels there, south of Iceland and north of Iceland. And those are quite narrow gaps when you think about the size of the whole Atlantic. And Bismarck and Prince Eugen are going to have to go through one of those gaps in order to get out into the main part of the Atlantic where the convoys are. So all sorts of efforts are made to spot both ships as they go through that narrow gap. And that, of course, is exactly what happens. Norfolk and Suffolk, two Royal Navy cruisers, pick up the two ships, shadow them, and as is well known, Hood and Prince of Wales are sent to intercept. There's a short naval battle, disastrously short for the Royal Navy, because after about 5 minutes, a shell hits Hood and Hood explodes and sinks, taking all but three of her crew with her, which is an enormous setback for the Royal Navy because the ship was iconic within the Royal Navy. It was one of the ships that was most well known in the media and always appeared in the newspapers and had done various tours around the world, sort of flying the flag, and everybody had heard of it. So when it was sunk by Germany's most iconic ship in a battle that only lasted 5 minutes, it was a real disaster for the Royal Navy.
Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gibt bekannt. Ein im Atlantik operierender deutscher Flottenverband unter Führung des Flottenchefs Admiral Lütjens stieß im Seegebiet um Island auf schwere englische Seestreitkräfte. Das Schlachtschiff Bismarck hat hierbei einen englischen Schlachtkreuzer, wahrscheinlich Hood, vernichtet.
There's public morale to consider there, isn't there, as well as actual tactical and practical considerations of the mechanics of war.
Absolutely. And when Churchill issues his famous order, you know, sink the Bismarck, he's not just talking about the operational effect of the ship in the Atlantic. He's also talking about the vital propaganda value. He's saying we have to get our own back publicly and sort this out.
Because, of course, the simple fact that they were on the water and not under it, hidden, as the U-boats were, there was a whole battle raging out of sight. This was much more iconic and visible just by the nature of the vessels themselves. These were things people were going to be aware of.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't make it any easier out in the vast stretch of the Atlantic, whether the ship's surfaced or a submarine. It's still very difficult to find. Prince of Wales manages to put a couple of hits on Bismarck, which cause it what turns out to be very significant damage. The ship isn't badly damaged, but the slight effect they have on it is just enough, as the events play out, to lead to it being sunk. But the problem they have after that is what's going to happen next? Where's Bismarck going to go? And Lütjens, the German admiral, decides to split his force and send Prince Eugen out into the Atlantic. But he thinks Bismarck is sufficiently badly damaged that they need to return to port and get the ship fixed. In particular, they've lost quite a lot of fuel in the process. So he's then got to figure out a way of getting back to Germany and avoiding the Royal Navy. And the Royal Navy obviously is trying to do the opposite. They're trying to track the ship down and sink it before it can make this run for home. And that's when the signals intelligence part of the story becomes important.
I worked in Hut 6, mostly, partly in Hut 8, but mostly in Hut 6. I was working on the Enigma, on the translations, allocating where they ought to go. In other words, what priorities they ought to have, because I spoke German. And so I had this relationship with this thing coming out of the tape, whether it was going to be so important it had to go straight to Whitehall, or whether it was going to be something very minor about somebody's knickers having broken or something, because somebody had to make that first allocation as to what was going to be done with it. So I and many others were in Hut 6, racing through all this material.
So you were working with Gordon Welshman then?
Well, I mean, he was one of the codebreakers, so he was much more important than me. I mean, they were so wonderful, the codebreakers, and they were on such a high the whole time. They could hardly speak. They were in such agonies. The agonies about, nearly every new code they were trying to break was just so agonising, because every minute meant thousands of people's lives were at risk. And so we couldn't really touch there. We couldn't even get near them because they were in such a state of controlled ecstasy, turning to agony, turning to ecstasy. They were an extraordinary crowd, unique people.
How did you come to be here in the first place? What was your way in? How were you
here,
invited?
Got a letter from a friend, my greatest friend, actually, who had somehow got here, been invited here, and she wrote and said, "Well, desperately busy, Jane. We desperately need people like you to help us. Why don't you come?"
Were you fresh from school?
Yes, fresh from school.
Yes.
And when I got here, of course, it was full of my friends, because they'd all been invited the same way. Quite extraordinary.
And was it largely because of you were a linguist?
I think the German thing was very influential. But I had just done a secretarial course also, so that, I suppose, was thought to be useful. And I did know a lot of the people here, and I was somebody who was prepared to come and give my life for it, which is what we all were prepared to do.
So you just came and started straight away without any...
Yes, absolutely,
visit.
Thrown in at the deep end.
Signed the Official Secrets Act on your first day.
Quite right. I went to see Travis, I think it was Travis when I first arrived, who was the head of the show, and I was interviewed by a man called Milner Barry, who was head of Hut 6, who was a King's Cambridge man and very knowledgeable, very good mathematician, very good chess player. Never interviewed a woman in his life, I don't think. He hadn't got the slightest idea what to say to me or anything, except he knew I was a person who might be put on a seat and get on with it. And so he said, "Well, I think we'll go and see Travis." So we went to see Travis. And he said, "Well, I want you to sign the Official Secrets Act, Jane." Didn't ask me anything about myself at all. And there was another 18-year-old sitting on another seat. And we were the people who did it, just because we were there.
And how many years were you here for?
5 years. Anybody else would have done it if they happened to find themselves in that position.
Now, I gather there was a birthday message to the ship's commander, and that helped somehow in a strangely sort of arm's-length kind of way.
It does, because after the battle, Bismarck is being shadowed by Prince of Wales and by HMS Suffolk, tracking Bismarck by radar. But the Germans managed to evade Suffolk and Prince of Wales. And at that point, the only way they can be identified is by intercepting their radio transmissions. And this is where the story becomes interesting from a GCNCS point of view, because at that time, Bletchley Park was reading German naval Enigma traffic, but not straight away. Each message was typically taking between 4 to 7 days to break. So they're only reading the messages sort of the following week, if you like. And the content of the messages that were sent by Bismarck wasn't read until after the battle was over. And that's led some people to say that Bletchley had no role in the battle and that it was different things that led to the sinking. But actually, there's more to intercepting Enigma messages than reading the content. And this is where what's called traffic analysis becomes really important. What happened was the German admiral thought he was still being shadowed by Suffolk. And he was fully aware that if he sent a radio transmission, Y stations in the UK would be able to pick it up and they would do what's called direction finding. They would triangulate on that signal from several Y stations and get a bearing of where the originating transmitter was. So it's normal practice for ships at sea to try and send as few radio messages as they can to avoid being
triangulated
by DF. However, because he thought he was being shadowed by Suffolk and thus on radar anyway, he thought, "Well, I'm free to send a message because they already know where I am." And he sent a very long message, including lots of detail about his sinking of the Hood and his current state, the damage to his own ship and everything else. And he thought, I'm clear to send this because I'm not giving anything away by sending it. What he didn't know was the Royal Navy had lost him at that point. And he then went on to send a number of other messages at various points in his voyage, each of which could be picked up. The problem with this is you have a radio signal emanating from somewhere in the Atlantic. And it's not just Bismarck that's out there. Prince Eugen is out there, German supply ships are out there, U-boats are out there. And there are some points when it's thought that messages might be from Bismarck and they're not. In one case, they pick up a message on a U-boat frequency. There's some debate about whether that might be Bismarck for some reason transmitting on a different frequency. Actually, it turns out later that it was a U-boat all along. But what's interesting about this is it brings another couple of techniques that were used into focus. One of these is a system called TINA, which is where you look at a radio operator's, what's called his fist, any Morse operator, they type out dots and dashes. Those dots and dashes are minutely different from another radio operator's dots and dashes. And an experienced listener will be able to tell who's transmitting on each occasion. And so people in the wire stations listening to the Morse code coming from Bismarck, experts would be able to say, yes, that's a particular radio operator. And so that's the same chap as broadcast last time. So it must be the same ship. And so that's a very important technique. Another one is radio fingerprinting, it's called, where you look at the detail of the electronic transmission. And because all radio transmitters are manufactured from components that are microscopically different from one another, if you look in great detail at a signal, you can tell the unique traces of each transmitter. And both those techniques were being used in the case of Bismarck to work out which radio messages were coming from Bismarck and which radio messages were coming from other ships or submarines. So it's a window on the much more complicated world of traffic analysis that was going on alongside the code breaking.
There was a German officer who nearly gave the game away, I gather, by trying to find out what became of a relative of his who was on board the Bismarck.
Yes, this is proof that you should never give away information regardless of how irrelevant you think it is. There was a German Luftwaffe officer who was in Athens at the time, connected with the preparations for the invasion of Crete. He had a family member on board Bismarck. He pulled rank a little bit and sent a message from Athens on the Luftwaffe Enigma, which Bletchley Park was reading more or less straight away. He sent a message asking what the fate of the ship was and whether his relative was going to be all right. Because obviously the battle with Hood had been on the news and things, and he was aware that the ship had been in battle. A message was sent back to him saying, "Don't ask us, ask Paris," which may sound trivial, but it's crucial because while Bismarck was operating in the northern Atlantic, it was sending its messages back and forth from German Navy Command in Germany. And part of the decision to move to a French port meant that it started sending its messages to Paris instead of to Germany. And so the inference from that message was that Bismarck was heading for France rather than turning back and trying to go back around north of Scotland again and back to Norway or Germany. Because that was the problem the Royal Navy had, was Bismarck was more or less equidistant from France or Norway, and each was a viable option. It could have backtracked and gone back round via Iceland to Norway, or could carry on and get round to Brest or Lorient or Saint-Nazaire in France.
And so was that a real linchpin of the operation, do you think, or is it just something that helped?
It's another piece of the jigsaw. One of the problems with signals intelligence and Enigma is people often ask, what was the crucial piece of information? What message can we look at and say, this made the difference? It's not that straightforward. Actually, the job of the intelligence officers is to put together a whole string of different clues and draw a conclusion from the whole lot. They're not going to take one message and go, well, this clinches it.
This is the answer to everything. Yeah.
They're more or less going to take that message and go, right, we've got this direction in finding information. We've got these other signals we don't fully understand. We've got this little snippet from here. And it all just goes together to build your certainty and your conclusions.
The Bismarck, yeah, that was my most exciting time, I suppose. I happened to be on duty, and most things here happened in that way. Either you were on duty or you weren't. And if you were on duty, you took what came to you. If there was something needing to be done, you did it. And I suddenly got a thing on my plate coming out of the Enigma machine, which said Brest on it. And I happened to know, because everybody knew, that the main part of our fleet was somewhere in the channel trying to intercept the Bismarck, which was the Germans' newest and most important battleship. And I just thought that that might be very important, so I read it right through. And this is now common news. Everybody knows that that was how we found out about it. One of the senior officers in the German army, I think it must have been, because I was really in the army section, telegraphed the captain of the Bismarck saying, "I'm worried about my son who's on board. and I want to know where you're going. And we all thought she was going back into the fjords, so we were all lined up to stop her doing that. What she was actually doing was streaking away down into Brest. So we got her. The whole fleet was turned round, and off they went in pursuit. Sunk her. I mean, we were all in it. We all did what we could.
Yes.
And that was what I did. And it was very, very exciting because it did save thousands of lives, but not before they'd already sunk the Hood. And they had this marvellous amount of armoury, didn't they? Mm. The latest possible guns and everything, so they could really sink more or less anything if they decided to.
It became quite a confident point of view that the ship was headed towards France.
Yes.
And so then what happened?
A series of pieces of good luck, essentially. The Ark Royal, which was based in Gibraltar at the time for convoy protection work, was sent northwards with a variety of accompanying ships to try and intercept and get in the way between the French coast and Bismarck. There was an earlier attack from the other carrier that was present, HMS Victorious. Incredibly brave effort in these biplane aircraft, Swordfish torpedo bombers. And they hit the ship several times, but the torpedoes did no damage. There are signals, again, picked up by Bletchley Park from Admiral Lutyens saying, hit by torpedo, but torpedo hit of no consequence, is what the message says, because it just hit the armour belt in a place that wasn't particularly vulnerable. Ark Royal is able to send off torpedo bombers to attack the Bismarck. Again, there's real difficulty knowing exactly where she is, and these aircraft are at the extreme of their range. Basically, they fly them off as soon as they can, and they have enough fuel to essentially get to Bismarck and hopefully get back again. They're helped because a flying boat flies out and manages to spot the ship. They've been given search areas based on the signals intelligence information, so they know roughly where to look to find her. She's spotted by a flying boat, and that allows the torpedo aircraft to attack. They get a lucky hit on the rear of Bismarck, which jams the rudders. And what that means basically is the ship after that can only sail in a circle. And the captain and the admiral come up with all sorts of ideas to try and fix the rudders and the engines to make the ship sail in a straight line, but it won't.
So it can't get away.
And so it can't get away. It's a sitting duck at that point.
Yeah.
And once they know where it is and that it's not going anywhere, the rest of the Royal Navy's surface ships close in, battleships and destroyers close in, and it's all over for the Germans at that point.
Members of ENSA, they have entertained in the last few months officers and gallant men on the Hood. You will feel as I feel about their last great gallant sacrifice. But the British Navy has in all its decades of history taken good care to avenge things of that kind. And that is why this morning at 11 o'clock the Bismarck was sunk.
Of course, from this distance we now think about the loss of life without taking sides in quite the same way, I think. It was disastrous for all those people on board. But, of course, it was a great triumph in terms of the course of the war. Right.
And actually one U-boat is there shadowing the Royal Navy, but it's got no torpedoes left. So it can't attack. All it does is radio their position and try and contribute by letting people know where they are.
Information.
Absolutely, yeah.
How important a morale boost was that at that time? The way the war was going?
I think it was very important, certainly in the light of the sinking of the Hood. The balance was sort of squared again by catching and sinking Bismarck. And you can only really call it a strategic draw from that point of view, in the sense that both sides lost an important ship and a great many lives. That Bismarck was not allowed to run free in the Atlantic and sink convoys is also a big factor. It never got to do what it was built for. And subsequently, Tirpitz isn't sunk until very near the end of the war, but only sails operationally once or twice, because having lost one of his two big main battleships, Hitler becomes so uncomfortable with them going to sea that Tirpitz almost becomes too precious to use. He becomes very, very cautious about using the ship because the other one's been sunk. Had Bismarck been successful, I think Tirpitz would have been at sea very shortly after, and, you know, who knows where we would have been. It's a vital good news story for the British. And if you consider that the Americans aren't in the war yet in May 41, but they will be by Christmas, the Americans have a very strong interest in what's happening in the Atlantic and the convoys, because a lot of the convoy ships are American. You know, they're supplying us with materials, even though they're neutral. And so the ability of the Royal Navy to be effective in the Atlantic is vital for that relationship with the US as well.
And aside from the cost of human life, which is just immeasurable, really, with those two sinkings, the Hood and the Bismarck, these both must have cost a fortune to build in terms of investment. And did the German Navy look at sort of replacing it? And did we sort of carry on along that route in that kind of warfare? Or did it change the course of how the war played out at sea?
Well, the Germans don't build any major capital ships after that. Their programme allowed for them to build more ships, but they didn't build any more by that point. I think even by 1941, their economy was sufficiently stretched, and they had diverted most of their shipbuilding effort into building submarines, and they concentrate on building U-boats. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is they realise that their surface fleet is ultimately vulnerable. They've lost Graf Spee, famously, in 1939, and then they lose Bismarck. And at that point, it becomes clear that sending Tirpitz to sea is a very risky undertaking. You know, the war isn't being fought that way anymore.
As with any story of action in war, there are many different versions of what happened. And I've seen that there's one version that says it was sunk, and another version that says, no, it wasn't sunk, it was scuttled. What is scuttling, for a start, and what's the truth of it?
Essentially, all ships can sink themselves voluntarily. You have valves in the bottom of the ship which you can open that let water in, and it will then sink.
So what's your opinion then? Was it scuttled or was it sunk?
I don't think it matters ultimately. It sank, and if they did open the seacocks, it would only have been because they were about to sink anyway.
So it was defeated?
It was defeated,
either way.
Yeah.
It was taken out of service, out of action. It couldn't do the job it was built for. It's an example of how the complexity of the picture that signals intelligence builds up can be vital. And it's not as simple as a eureka message. So we've read this person in this location is saying this, so now we know X, Y, Z. There's a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's tiny pieces of information being collated together by people who can then try and figure out the big picture. And you never get a piece of information that's completely unequivocal that says, your enemy is going to do this. All you ever get is hints. And it was a combination of a whole series of diverse hints and a good healthy dollop of luck that made the operation a success. And I think the signals intelligence is one part in that jigsaw, which if you took away, the outcome might have been very different.
Well, it seems extraordinary when you look at these funny old things, which is us, that we actually did it, doesn't it? And they were all working incredibly hard. I mean, we regularly worked 12-hour shifts, but I worked 24-hour shift over the Bismarck thing because I just happened to get it. And so we did work. By today's standards, I would say we were workaholics. We were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. It may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives.
Absolutely.
We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.